From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, along with other federal agencies, conducted a secret campaign against Albert Einstein for 32 years, tapping his phone, opening his mail, searching his garbage, and amassing 1,800 pages of what they called derogatory information.
The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's secret war against the world's most famous scientist. But first, we'll look at another FBI investigation. Why it has taken so long and it has been so inept. In the past week, the FBI has searched the home of one U.S. bioweapons scientist twice. We'll look at his history. His name is Stephen Hatfield. He was in Zimbabwe, or then Rhodesia, in 1978 to 80, when Rhodesia had the biggest anthrax outbreak among humans ever recorded, the one that sickened more than 10,000 black farmers in Zimbabwe. There's evidence the anthrax was released by the white Rhodesian army. Hatfield also has on his resume involvement in the former South African Defense Force, then ends up as a scientist at Fort Detrick, Maryland, in the U.S. biodefense program. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting Kurdish leaders in northern Iraq say they would be reluctant to join a U.S. attack on Iraq. The first President Bush encouraged a Kurdish uprising during the Persian Gulf War, but as U.S. troops refused to intervene, Iraqi forces brutally suppressed the uprising, killing thousands. The New York Times story follows last week's report that the U.S. military has drawn up a plan for invading Iraq involving up to 250,000 troops. Meanwhile, the London Telegraph is reporting Britain is preparing to commit at least 30,000 troops to the U.S. invasion. Outraged Afghan villagers say U.S. soldiers stormed their homes and barred them from treating their wounded relatives after a U.S. bombing killed 48 civilians and injured 117 at a wedding party. The Agence France-Presse is reporting one of President Hamid Karzai's senior military commanders, Mohammed Anwar, says many people died from loss of blood and could have been saved if they were allowed treatment. Anwar also says the bombing burnt off the clothes of many of the villagers. U.S. troops wouldn't allow the bodies to be covered and kept filming and photographing the naked women. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's newly created Human Rights Commission has called for the immediate release of a preliminary report into the bombing. U.S. investigators say their joint inquiry with Afghanistan into last week's attack will not be available for several weeks. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader Friday called on the Securities and Exchange Commission to reopen its investigation into President Bush's 1990 sale of Harkin Energy stock. Bush sold the stock for some $850,000 just 2 months before its value sank under the weight of bad earnings reports. Bush was a member of Harkin's audit committee. Bush has recently criticized companies for bookkeeping scandals and is planning to give a major address on the issue of corporate crime on Tuesday. Some 50 African heads of state are in Durban, South Africa, for the final summit of the Organization of African Unity to launch the African Union. The heads of state plan to set up a central bank and African Court of Justice under the AU and work towards a single currency. The African Union will be closely linked to NEPAD, Africa's neoliberal economic plan. The world's biggest conference on AIDS began amid controversy in Barcelona on Sunday as protesters chanted throughout the opening ceremony. Meanwhile, the U.S. pharmaceutical company Vaxgen says a vaccine against AIDS could be available within 5 years. We go now to Barcelona, to John Riley, who is a reporter for Pacifica Station WBAI's Health Action and an activist with ACT UP New York. That's the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Thanks, Amy.
Well,
I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you with us. The 14th annual International AIDS Conference opened in Barcelona yesterday. Can you describe what's happened over this last 24 hours?
The pace of this 14,000-person conference is breathtaking, with announcements affecting the lives of millions of people worldwide being made every day. The conference started with two demonstrations, or activities around the conference started with two demonstrations, one on Saturday and the other yesterday, just before the conference started. Hundreds rallied and marched at Saturday's rally, which was organized by a network of Spanish aid service organizations, which used guerrilla theater and props to send their message that the pharmaceutical company's high prices are causing the deaths of millions of people with AIDS in Africa, Asia, and South America. With banners calling for AIDS treatment and others reading, "Where is the $10 billion needed for the Global Fund to fight AIDS?" Activists made their point very clear. Activists also added a giant 25-foot helium balloon, which floated 40 feet above the stage in the shape of a red and white bill inscribed with the inscription, "Patents at what price?" Activists feel particular urgency as the death toll for this year alone from AIDS will be 2 million people, 90% of whom, they say, could have their lives saved by using existing antiretroviral therapy. But only 30,000 people in all of AIDS-devastated Africa will have access to treatment this year. Little money from the Global Fund is going to treatment. The bulk of the money is going for dance troupes and mosquito nets to fight malaria. Activists from South Africa, though, are celebrating a victory from their constitutional court. Just days ago, the court ruled that TAC, the Treatment Action Campaign, was correct in their criticism of the South African government for failing to extend AIDS treatment in the form of two doses of nevirapine, one to mother and one to child, to prevent HIV infection of children. The South African government had limited their program to only two clinics in each of the nine provinces in South Africa, where something like 27% of pregnant women are HIV positive. The Treatment Action Campaign has put together a coalition representing 5 million people in organizations, which is developing a court-mandated, negotiated national treatment plan. And today, or just in the last day, the World Health Organization surprised activists here by announcing a goal of having 3 million people in treatment with AIDS drugs, antiretroviral drugs, by the year 2005. It's a plan which many activists consider ambitious but doable if roadblocks put up by the U.S. administration can be knocked down. Additionally, earlier you mentioned, Amy, Vaxgen, and that they are announcing that they're the only company that is in the final stages of development of an AIDS vaccine. That announcement has raised concerns of many activists who fear that partial protection might end up leading to a worse outcome than no vaccination at all. A scientist by the name of Andrew Reed said that partial protection vaccines under some circumstances could select for more pathogenic virus, which could create a disease even more devastating than the current virus. Activists are also concerned that if we place our hopes on a vaccine that may never actually be approved, instead of relying on the treatments that are available now, that millions of people's lives will be lost. And the activists believe that we need to do both, fight the virus with the drugs that exist, and also develop a vaccine. And are there any questions you have for me, Amy?
Well, in the last day after these two protests, what is your feeling, having covered a number of these international conferences, of where activists around the world now stand in relation to governments in terms of their feeling, their attitude toward what they're doing about AIDS?
Well, I think many activists feel that governments are in some ways attempting to co-opt the language of the activists without really implementing what the intent of the activists are. So they believe that we must really build a more powerful movement like the activists in South Africa have if we're to actually win these plans, because all of this could be swept away if we ignore the attempts by the U.S. government to protect drug company profits. Right now, the U.S. government has two strategies for doing that. One of the strategies is to put in more restrictive regulations concerning intellectual property into the regional trade agreements, like the Free Trade of the Americas. And the other is a question that the U.S. government is trying to roll back the gains that were made at Doha in Qatar that happened last year, because the U.S. government doesn't want poor countries to be able to import generic AIDS drugs from other countries that are producing those generic equivalents.
Well, John, we'll continue to follow these issues through the week as the 14th International AIDS Conference goes on in Barcelona, Spain, where you are, John Riley, who is with Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. And finally, friends and family of the two people killed in the July 4th shooting at the LL ticket counter at Los Angeles International Airport gathered on Sunday to mourn the victims. The FBI is still refusing to call the attack terrorists. Officials say the shooter was possibly despondent over his personal or business affairs.
Did I drink some poison? Did I drink some poison? That I don't remember. Is the blood on my hands? No, my hands are clean. Did I do something in another lifetime that was really, really me? Yeah, I'm hearing voices. Am I losing my mind? Think I'm going crazy, gotta get out. Running into the street, start to shout. Get out of my way. Get out, get out. Did I drink some poison? That I don't remember now. Is the blood on my hands? Did I do something in another lifetime?
Poison, Laurie Anderson, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 6 months after questioning former Army biological weapons scientist Stephen Hatfill, the FBI finally searched his Maryland apartment last week. They were looking for evidence about the anthrax-laced letters that killed five people last fall. Also last week, Barbara Hatch Rosenberg of the Federation of American Scientists criticized the FBI at a Senate briefing. She says they failed to aggressively pursue a likely suspect. Rosenberg didn't mention Hatfill by name, but her description closely resembles him. Today we're going to do some investigating of our own, looking at who this likely suspect is and also looking at the FBI's investigation. Stephen Hatfill attended medical school in Zimbabwe. It was then known as Rhodesia in the late 1970s, during the largest ever known outbreak of anthrax. This was the largest outbreak among humans ever recorded, the one that sickened more than 10,000 black farmers in Zimbabwe, 1978 to 80. There's evidence that the anthrax was released by the white Rhodesian army fighting against black guerrillas. In the 1990s, Hatfill worked at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland, the military's top bioterrorism research facility. Hatfill is closely connected to biological weapons training programs run by the CIA. Several years ago, he commissioned a study of a hypothetical terrorist attack in which anthrax is sent through the mail. Last fall's letters were laced with the Ames strain. The Ames strain has been distributed to about 20 U.S. labs since 1981. Only four facilities are believed to have the ability to produce the highly lethal dry powder form the letters contained. The Fort Detrick Bioweapons Lab, where Hatfill worked, is one of those facilities. Instead of beginning with a narrow investigation of these four labs, the FBI cast a wide net, looking as far afield as Iraq and Russia. The FBI insists Hatfill isn't even a suspect. The FBI waited until December to open the intact anthrax envelope it found, and it didn't obtain anthrax strains from various labs for comparison until March. The testing is still not complete. New York Times columnist Nicholas Krustoff wrote in an op-ed piece last week, quote, "If Mr. Z were an Arab national, he would have been imprisoned long ago. But he is a true blue American with close ties to the U.S. Defense Department, the CIA, and the American Biodefense Program." We're going to talk to two people who've been following this story. Scott Shane is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun who's been covering anthrax for the paper since the first anthrax death on October 4th. And Meryl Nass is with us. She is a physician, writer, anthrax expert. She identified the 1979 anthrax outbreak in Zimbabwe as bioterrorism, and we'll go to her first in Maine. Dr. Meryl Nass, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you talk about who Stephen Hatfill is?
Based on his resume, he appears to be an American who, oddly enough, went to Rhodesia during its civil war, while working for the American Army. His role there is uncertain, but there was an active chembio offensive program in Rhodesia at that time. He wound up going to medical school in Rhodesia and subsequently moved to South Africa, where there was also a very active chembio offensive program. Now, we don't know for certain that he had anything to do with either of these programs, but he has alleged that he served in both militaries of Rhodesia and South Africa, and that he was in a unit called the Celis Scouts, which my sources believe had something to do with spreading anthrax back in the late 70s.
Can you talk more about Rhodesia and then South Africa, and then we're going to move forward and talk also with Scott Shane?
Well, back in the 70s, Rhodesia was being embargoed by the United States and Great Britain and almost every other nation. The very small white minority had taken over the government while Rhodesia was a British colony in order to prevent transfer to majority rule. And that occurred around 1965, and a 15-year guerrilla war ensued, which was a very dirty war. A number of horrible atrocities occurred, which were later pinned on units of the white Rhodesian government, which were very desperate to win, so that there were, for instance, massacres of white people, farmers, nuns, priests, and made to look as if the black guerrillas had done it. And in addition, there are reports of the use of a number of different biological agents, including hepatitis, cholera, anthrax, and some chemical agents, including organophosphates, thallium, and warfarin, against both blacks in Rhodesia and blacks who may have assisted the Rhodesians in surrounding countries.
And Wouter Basson, if you could briefly touch on him.
Basson is the South African physician who was charged with developing the South African biological offensive and defensive program, and is said to have single-handedly created a massive, successful program which developed weapons for assassination and for mass killings, again, both within South Africa for assassinations outside of South Africa, for instance, in Europe, and for mass killings in frontline states surrounding South Africa, where South African defense forces also were involved. But Basson was just tried. He had the longest trial in South African history, which I believe lasted over 2 years. The prosecuting attorney, the attorney general, felt that the judge was not even-handed, and he was cleared of all charges, and now there are questions as to whether there will be an appeal by the Attorney General, and also whether he will be remanded to some of the other nations where he's alleged to have participated in murders.
Mm-hmm. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, Scott Shane will take us through the research he has done on the latest biodefense researcher to have his home searched. His name is Stephen Hatfield. And then we'll go back and forth between history and where Dr. Hatfield has been and what we know today about where the FBI investigation is into the anthrax assassin or assassins. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the scientist whose home was searched twice in the last week, Stephen Hatfield. On the line with us, Dr. Merrill Nass, who is an anthrax expert, a physician and writer, and Scott Shane, who is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Scott Shane, can you talk about what you know about the FBI searching the apartment in this past week of Stephen Hatfield?
Sure. Probably makes sense to go back a little bit and just review what happened before the search of Hatfield's home. When the letters were mailed, if people remember the early reports of that, they contained messages that at least superficially appeared to make them to associate them with militant Islam. Allah is great, and so on. And there are still knowledgeable people who don't exclude the possibility that they came from a foreign country, they came from Iraq, they came from Al-Qaeda, and so on. But the FBI, and I think probably it's fair to say most others who've studied the envelopes and the facts, concluded that they were more likely to have been sent by an American. The particular point that's hard to attribute to a foreign terrorist is the fact that the letters contained the phrases, or a couple of the letters contained the phrases, "This is anthrax, take penicillin." And that indicated that the goal was not to just kill people and spread terror, because if you wanted to do that, you would have just let the people die with no warning. And So people, I think the most plausible theory that most people who've studied the anthrax letters have come up with is that this is someone who, possibly among other motives, felt it was his duty to wake up the country, wake up the government to the threat of bioterrorism. Coming right after September 11th, It's possible to imagine someone who's very concerned about the threat of bioterrorism killing millions of Americans thinking, well, I have to wake up people. I'll send these letters and get people's attention.
I think very few people know that these letters said, "This is anthrax, take penicillin."
Well, interestingly enough, although the FBI has been very sealed up about the progress of its investigation, early on it created a website, which you can easily find at FBI.gov, or if you do a search for their somewhat remarkable title for the investigation, which is Amerithrax. if you go to that website, they have pictures of the fronts of the envelopes, so you can see and the notes inside. So you can see both the envelopes with their return address and address and the notes that are inside. So, anyway, to continue, the focus soon came to the relatively small number of Americans who have had access to Ames strain anthrax, have knowledge of biological weapons, and even more narrowly, although this is not absolutely required, the people who've been vaccinated against anthrax and therefore might feel safer working with it. So Hatfill, Stephen Hatfill, is a medical doctor and PhD and worked for 2 years, 97 to 99, at USAMRIID, the U.S. Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Frederick, Maryland, not far from Washington, Baltimore, which is the Army's Biological Defense Center. And prior to 1969, when President Nixon closed the old Offensive Biological Weapons Program, was the center of the Biological Weapons Program. Anyway, he worked there for 2 years on a fellowship. He's also worked at NIH, and he's also worked for a defense contractor called the Science Applications International Corporation. And he, like it must be said, at least you know, a few dozen other people fit a number of criteria that would attract the FBI's attention: vaccination against anthrax, knowledge of anthrax. He never worked directly with anthrax in his official research, but he spoke publicly on a number of occasions about having witnessed the anthrax outbreak in Rhodesia, and also he spoke about how easy it was to for a bioterrorist to cook up a mixture of plague or anthrax or some other biological agent in his kitchen with easily obtained ingredients and that sort of thing. I guess the problem of Stephen Hatfill is the problem at the core of this investigation, which is that the people who are engaged in biological defense and presumably in most cases sincerely have worked to prepare the country's defenses against some kind of biological attack are also, by nature of their experience and access to anthrax and so on, on the FBI's list of suspects. And Fort Detrick, where USAMRIID, the Army's Biodefense Center, is sort of at the core of that paradox, because they worked, many people out there worked round the clock in the early days of the anthrax mailings, because, as you recall, there were so many hoaxes, so many letters being sent around here and there with white powder, or people just noticing white powder on a desk. They did something like 30,000 tests, many of them put in many hours of unpaid overtime, and then sort of the next thing that happens is a lot of those people are getting wired up to the polygraph machine and asked whether they mailed the anthrax letters. So it's a paradoxical situation, it's an ironic situation to begin with, and I think it's probably fair to say that Hatfill is currently at the core of that paradox. There's been a lot written about him since his apartment was searched. Reportedly, it's hard to be absolutely certain of what the FBI is up to, but the FBI, I did speak with Hatfill a couple times. He told me that the FBI had questioned him and polygraphed him, and he said that he passed the polygraph. He supposedly, there was at least a superficial search done at an earlier time, I believe, of his Frederick apartment. I'm not certain of that, but this time, it's really almost 2 weeks ago now, they backed a Ryder truck up to his apartment building, which is right outside Fort Detrick, the gates of Fort Detrick, and people went in and out all day with, you know, garbage bags and pulled a lot of stuff out, did a lot of testing, reportedly found no, in subsequent tests of what they removed, found no traces of anthrax, no spores of anthrax. So the FBI has emphasized that he is not the prime suspect or the leading suspect or anything like that. They call him a person of interest and say that he's one of a lot of other persons of interest because of the nature of their access and their expertise. And I have to say that I started looking at Hatfill back in January, and learned a lot about him, and you know, he looked like a very interesting person in this regard. But I'm not aware of any evidence that anyone has come up with that links him directly to the mailing of these letters. And his somewhat controversial history in Rhodesia and South Africa, whatever political views he may hold, whatever statements he may have made in the past.
Can you talk about those, whatever those political views might be, what they are?
Well, I mean, I haven't discussed politics with him. I can say that in conversations with his classmates from medical school in Rhodesia in the 80s, they described him as extremely right-wing, and they said that he would make statements that even in the white Rhodesian context seemed offensively racist. But that was, of course, 20 years ago in a very different context. I really don't know what his politics are today. But all I was going to say is that none of that background really has any direct bearing on whether he's the guy who mailed these letters. And I think it's quite possible to forget that. And the name Richard Jewell may ring a bell with listeners. He was the guy who the FBI arrested in it for the bombing that backpack that blew up at the Atlanta Olympics, who was actually pretty much pilloried in the press, and he turned out to be completely innocent. And as in other contexts, you know, we have rounded up a lot of Arab Americans and Arab immigrants in the terrorism context. And certainly there have been questions raised about the violation of the rights of those people, and it's probably worth saying that even a right-wing 48-year-old white American male is innocent until proven guilty, and that unless someone comes up with some evidence that links him directly to these letters, we probably ought to cool off a little bit on our focus on this guy.
Scott Shane is with the Baltimore Sun. Well, there is this question that Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times ends his piece with, talking about, following up on his involvement, evidence that the anthrax was released by the White Rhodesian Army fighting against black guerrillas. He referred to the person that he's wondering hasn't been investigated as Mr. Z, and said Mr. Z has claimed he participated in the White Army's much-feared Selous Scouts. And then he ends by saying, could rogue elements of the American military have backed the Rhodesian Army in anthrax and cholera attacks against blacks? Mr. Z's resume also claims involvement in the former South African Defense Force. All else aside, who knew that the U.S. Defense Department would pick an American who had served in the armed forces of two white racist regimes to work in the American biodefense program with some of the world's deadliest germs? What now? When do you shift into high gear? Well, let's put that question to Dr. Merrill Ness.
You know, I really agree with Scott Shane about Hadfield. Hadfield has an amazing profile. You know, the guy looks like he has been an agent. He has a lot of knowledge that it doesn't explain in his resume how he got it about biological weapons. For instance, his lack of any obvious experience with anthrax at any time in his career. He has gaps in his resume, like a year in Antarctica, where he could have been involved in black programs. But all that aside, there isn't clear-cut evidence linking him to the crime, and I think that one needs to look at the crime itself a little bit more carefully. I believe that the intention was not to kill, but to provide a wake-up call, and yet the person or persons who sent these letters had to have been risk-takers because they realized they were sending very deadly, huge quantities of anthrax in the mail and that there might be deaths, and they were prepared to accept deaths. This is a serial murder investigation. The targets were Congress and the media, and I think if we assume that the wake-up call was the reason, the targets were appropriately chosen to get lots of publicity And to make the Congress concerned, Congress, of course, controls the purse strings for spending on biological defense and terrorism. I think it was a political crime. I think that the person or persons who committed this crime had some very special access. They had access to the bacteria. They either obtained, stole, or produced this bacteria in a manner that very, very few people knew how to do. First of all, the United States has signed an international treaty banning biological weapons, and essentially we're not even allowed to possess anthrax in this form, which is purely a form that can be used as a weapon and is not necessary for research. So this person found out how to do something that very few people would have known how to do, managed to do it in an area which was safe. The FBI has apparently not found a spot or not investigated a spot which might be contaminated with spores. And I emphasize this because in order to fill envelopes with those spores in that preparation, you absolutely had to have contamination of the local area. You could not put that spore preparation into an envelope without losing millions of spores. So there is a place where those spores are. Now, they may have been killed through irradiation or fumigation, ozonation, but you can't get rid of all of them because you can't see them. You can only see them under a microscope. So if the FBI is swabbing someone's home or place of work and trying to grow anthrax from the spores, if they've been treated, you may not be able to grow anything. But if you look carefully under the microscope, you may see some non-viable spores. I think the fact that the person knew how to do this, that letters were sent from different cities, and apparently no one person was in all those cities at the same time, suggests that there may have been more than one. And, you know, similarly, in terms of the question whether rogue elements of the U.S. military who were secretly supporting Rhodesia in South Africa back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, were there perhaps rogue elements of the U.S. government who were secretly supporting this particular act, perhaps with all due patriotism as their intention, but still a criminal act was committed. We've had five deaths, a number of illnesses, and four of the people who developed inhalation anthrax, four or five, and survived are chronically ill. So the question comes to mind, has the FBI been made to be desultory in its investigation of this crime because, in some sense, there was official acknowledgement, official tacit agreement with sending the anthrax.
Dr. Nassa, in a piece that you put out today, you say there are only a small number of government scientists and contractors who are known to work with anthrax. Interestingly enough, the scientist who's been publicly investigated was not among them. According to his resume and publications, he's never worked with anthrax, yet his anthrax vaccinations provided by government agencies were up to date. Why? While the Defense Department, you write, was forced to curtail military anthrax vaccinations due to lack of supply, this scientist was given his yearly boosters. Did someone in the Defense Department, which owns the entire anthrax vaccine stockpile, think he needed it badly? Who authorized those vaccinations? Who was the scientist working for? What had he been doing since returning to the U.S. from South Africa and the U.K.? Fourth, what were the scope of his pursuits during the years? His resume says he was obtaining three master's degrees and a PhD in addition to his medical degree. And you talk about the level of the knowledge of the White House before they let on to knowing much, beginning by saying amid the uproar over the former Fort Detrick scientist with the spooky background in Rhodesia and South Africa. The glaring holes and inconsistencies in the anthrax investigation have been forgotten or perhaps conveniently overlooked. First, why was our government convinced from the start that the perpetrator is an American? Why did the White House announce this so early in the investigation? Although the administration might have learned the anthrax had a domestic origin from genetic studies of the Ames strain or the makeup of the additive that neutralized the spore's tendency to clump, the White House announcement preceded such studies by months. Did the president receive inside information which has never been shared with the public? What about answers to these questions?
Well, this has been a very interesting investigation because many of the most important things that the government has provided to the media have been provided in the absence of attribution. We don't know which spokesperson came up with the statement, and often the statements are contradictory over time. Those, I thought, were some of the very biggest questions that had never been answered and I think need to be answered, and now that we're having some congressional investigations of the FBI investigation of this crime, hopefully they will be asked and satisfactorily answered.
And Scott Shane, in one of your pieces, you talk about some new details that have emerged. And again, as you point out, we have no idea who sent this anthrax. That's very important to point out. The FBI's investigation, many feel, leaves a tremendous amount to be desired. Everything from allowing some anthrax to be destroyed to not investigating people in any kind of a forceful way over the months. But you point out an interesting detail that has emerged about the address on some of the anthrax letters. Can you talk about that?
Well, the address, the fictional address on some of the anthrax letters says Greendale School with a New Jersey address, and it's a made-up address. There's a very interesting analysis that's been done by a computer expert by the name of Richard M. Smith that's posted on the web in which he links it to certain parts of New Jersey, certain facts in New Jersey. But there is a suburb of Harare, Zimbabwe, about 5 miles from where Hatfield went to medical school, that's called Greendale. And some people have thought that there might be a connection there. There is a, on the other hand, if you put Greendale into Google on the internet, you find a whole lot of Greendales. So I think that falls far short of any kind of proof of anything. The other thing I just wanted to mention in connection with what Dr. Nass was saying is that my understanding is that Hatfield's vaccination was part of a package of vaccinations given to everyone at Fort Detrick that included anthrax. Okay.
Dr. Nass?
Fort Detrick get anthrax vaccine.
Can you repeat what you just said?
Yes. Very few people at Fort Detrick receive routine anthrax vaccine. Even Arthur Friedlander, who has been in charge of anthrax research at Fort Detrick, has not been vaccinated for years.
Okay, well, I'm incorrect then. The other thing I was going to say is that the, in terms of the special knowledge to prepare this powder, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the biological weapons field, and particularly on Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, which is an Army facility that has acknowledged making small quantities of dry powder anthrax of this kind for years for testing of biodetection equipment and decontamination techniques. But the pharmaceutical industry and the pesticide industry also prepares aerosol powders on a much, much larger scale. So there are hundreds and hundreds of people who work on producing dry, small particle aerosol powders for things like inhalers and certain pesticide applications, so that it's conceivable that people outside the you know, the sort of biological defense community would have expertise and access to equipment to make this stuff. And then the final thing is, final point has to do with the idea that the FBI might still be able to find some contamination. Of course, there's an obvious question, which is if Stephen Hatfield was a person of interest, as the FBI says, why would you wait, what has this been, you know, 8 months to search his apartment? you would think that in any investigation you would want to make the searches of that kind much earlier in the game. But that aside, there are you can go on the web and find glove bags, disposable glove bags, which could be used for filling the envelopes or doing other kinds of operations, which are disposable polyethylene bags with glove-shaped hands. So you stick your hands into these plastic gloves, and you can work inside the bag. If you then burn that, sank it to the bottom of the ocean, destroy it in some way, you know, it's conceivable that certainly with all these months, whoever mailed the letters might have been able to clean up his trail pretty well.
Dr. Ness, haven't you suggested that the reason people haven't been moved in on is because the U.S. government is concerned about the secrets they could reveal?
Well, that's one hypothesis. Certainly, Heschel, I'm sure, has many secrets. Whether that is influencing things, no one is sure.
I mean, it's very interesting, and this is something Ralph Nader raised after the State of the Union address when we were just commenting on it afterwards. He said, if you look at this address, a third of the address was devoted to the issue of terrorism and how the U.S. is going to deal with this. Not once did President Bush talk about anthrax, which was a tremendous threat and scare at that point. Why hasn't the U.S. administration and the newspapers following suit? There's been really very little written about this investigation. And then reading things like, astonishingly, the FBI allowed the destruction of anthrax stocks at Iowa State University, losing what might have been valuable genetic clues, waited until December to open the intact anthrax envelope it found. FBI didn't obtain anthrax strains from various labs for comparison until March, and the testing is still not complete. Why this, well, at best, you could say, what, lackadaisicalness, ineptness, cover-up, possibly?
I think I could add a couple of other details to that picture. One is, as I mentioned, Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, was the headquarters of the Offensive Biological Weapons Program. And though it was shut down after 1969 when Nixon decided to close it, and the cleanup took place between then and about 1972, there are still, I was able to find about two dozen guys, all men, all in their 70s and 80s, who are still living, who participated in making anthrax on an industrial scale back in the 50s and 60s. It is incredible when you see what a few grams of anthrax in a few envelopes have did to the government, to the postal system, into the, you know, public psyche. It's remarkable to talk to these guys who used to make 500-pound anthrax bombs with bomblets the size of Coke cans that would have scattered over a huge area. As one of them said, a city would be a small target. You know, they could contaminate an entire state, for example, with these bombs. These guys used to do this, you know, night and day. I interviewed a guy who had the job of climbing inside the centrifuge every night and scraping out with a spatula the anthrax mixture. What was remarkable was it took months before any of those guys were interviewed by the FBI, despite the fact that they're, you know, within easy lunch hour drive of the Washington field office of the FBI that's running the investigation. And those guys would have obviously been very valuable as sources of information early on. They could have cleared up a number of misconceptions that were out there about the way the stuff behaved. And the second thing, of course, is that they could have been, they might have been suspects. They might be suspects, or they might know of suspects. It's conceivable that, you know, someone had come to one of those people and asked them a lot of questions about, well, how do you make this stuff into a weapon? So it seemed remarkable that the FBI took 2, 3, 4 months, and in some cases they still haven't talked to some of those individuals. And I have no explanation for that whatsoever. I cannot, if you ask the FBI, they basically say, you know, we conduct a systematic investigation, we eventually get to everyone, we can't get to everyone right away. But it seemed very odd In one case, a guy was finally interviewed only after writing to the FBI and to the Homeland Security Office, saying, "I could be the anthrax terrorist. I live alone and I have two bathrooms, and I used to make this stuff for a living. You know, come interview me." And finally, they did.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion this week as we look at the latest news around whose homes the FBI is searching. Today we've been talking about Stephen Hatfill. And we want to thank Scott Shane of the Baltimore Sun for being with us, who's been writing about the anthrax investigation since the anthrax attacks last year, and Dr. Merrill Ness, Maine physician and writer. If people want to look at your information, Dr. Ness, on the web, where can they go?
Well, my website is www.anthraxvaccine.org, and I've written several articles on the anthrax attacks for the website redflagsweekly.com. May I just interject one last thing, which is that the perpetrator actually has succeeded in what was attempted, which is we were not attacked, according to the White House and FBI, by an outsider. This was a domestic problem, possibly from someone within or with a history of working for the government. And yet, we have now spent about $5 billion this year and the same next year to deal with threats which we are anticipating are coming from outside, but that may not really be the right place to be looking for problems. Maybe we need to look domestically.
And Scott Shane, your website?
You can find it at sunspot.net.
That's sunspot.net. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Scott Shane and Dr. Merrill Ness. Thanks for being with us. When we come back, we're going back in time. We're going to look at a file that the FBI did keep comprehensively, and it was of another scientist, Albert Einstein. We're going to look at J. Edgar Hoover's secret war against the world's most famous scientist. Stay with us.
You had a face like a man. Somebody said from the Bible he'd quote, there was dust on the man in the long black coat. Preacher was talking, there's a sermon he gave. He said every man's conscience is vile and depraved.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Man in the Long Black Coat, Joan Osborne, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we've been talking about the FBI's investigation into U.S. scientists who possibly could have been behind last fall's anthrax attacks. Well, today we're going to look at another scientist the FBI did investigate for more than two decades, the world's most famous scientist. The scientist who revolutionized the study of the physical world, rewriting the laws of space, time, and gravity. But he was also a pacifist, a Jewish immigrant who supported civil rights, disarmament, internationalism, and socialism. A friend of celebrated African-Americans Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, he dared to use his immense prestige to denounce Joseph McCarthy at the height of the McCarthy era and publicly urge witnesses to refuse to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Talking about Albert Einstein, the great physicist who gave the world the theory of relativity in 1919, J. Edgar Hoover launched a ruthless derogatory information campaign against Einstein in 1933, the year he emigrated from Germany to the United States. Fred Jerome is with us, the man who has unearthed Albert Einstein's FBI file. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Well, today we're going to begin the conversation, and then we'll continue it tomorrow. Talk about this file, how big it is, how extensive, why was Albert Einstein targeted?
The file is 1,800 pages long. Actually, I was able to get almost all of it released through the Freedom of Information Act with the help of the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington. Some of it had been released in 1983, but they had withheld at least 30% of it for reasons of so-called national security. The file I have is 1,800 pages long, and you describe many of the things that are in the file, Einstein's political activities, which are virtually unknown in this country. The image of this man is of an absent-minded, kindly old professor with his mind on another plane, you know, above the world and not capable or not interested in thinking about the world. It's just not true. He was very concerned and very concerned about many issues, particularly issues where he saw social injustice and spoke out on those issues like racial inequality and racism. He called America's worst disease, and he defended people he felt were victims of racial frame-ups, from the Scottsboro Boys to a whole group of others. And he joined with Paul Robeson in 1946 as co-chairman of a group called the American Crusade to End Lynching. At that time, right after World War I, there was a wave of lynchings in America. Right after World War II, a wave of lynchings, something like 50 to 80 lynchings took place within the first year of World War II, mostly directed at African-American soldiers who had fought for democracy in Europe and now were returning to this country to find the lynchers waiting. So there was this protest, and Einstein co-chaired the organization that spearheaded the protest, went to Washington. He didn't go, but he sent a letter to Truman, but the other organizers of the protest went to Washington and had a confrontation with Truman, who said that the country wasn't ready for an anti-lynching law at the time. But in any case, that was one example of Einstein's commitment to political activities on behalf of social justice. Just listening to your discussion of anthrax, I wanted to mention that one of the things he did was protest the bringing in of ex-Nazi scientists into this country, which after the war was thousands were brought in for a variety of things. There was one operation called Operation Paperclip, in which they brought a number of scientists who had worked in Dachau to work in the Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio. It's been documented. And Einstein was among a small handful of people who protested that operation, all of which was included in his FBI file by Hoover as yet another example of his subversive character. That's Einstein's subversive character.
Meanwhile, he had fled Germany, right?
He had fled Germany. And Hoover described the committee, the Crusade Against Lynching, as another example of a communist attempt to instill racial agitation. That was in Einstein's file as well. So that you get the story of Einstein's politics in the FBI file, but you get it through the very hostile, slanted description of the FBI.
And how aware was Albert Einstein of J. Edgar Hoover following him?
Well, he was aware of it in general. I mean, in 1948, he told a dinner guest, a dinner companion, that he said, "You know, my house is being watched, and they're watching me, and they write down what I say," and so on and so forth. And we know he said this because this was copied down by the FBI and included in his FBI file. Since the book's been published, I've gotten another letter, actually a few letters, but this one in which he again reiterates the fact that he knows there's a blacklist and he's high up on the blacklist, and he feels proud of it. He's not. But he didn't know the details. He didn't know, for example, that the FBI, with the help of, worked with the Army Intelligence to actually bar Einstein from working on the atom bomb.
Well, on that note, we're going to find out more tomorrow as we can bring you part two of this conversation with Fred Jerome, author of The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientists. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org and email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Yeh. Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. From Pacifica Radio at the Firehouse, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!